You know, as a pastor or a counselor, well, as a pastor, let's say, which I am, again, it's from my perspective, and hopefully, you know, you're able to find some meaning in this, I wear so many hats. I do so many different things. And so people come to me for a lot of different things, a lot of different ministry that I can provide, a lot of different questions that I can answer. And when it gets down to pastoral counseling, if you're good at it, or if you have a degree in it, if it's something you like to do, people will come to you for all sorts of reasons. Because you're good, because obviously they want results, they want relief, they want you to help them. But there's another reason why people come to me. And not just people within my own congregation, but why people are referred to me from outside my congregation. And I counsel people that I don't even know that aren't a part of my congregation every once in a while. Every once in a while. Fairly often. You know what that reason is?
You're free.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So at that point, then, am I being taken advantage of?
I would say yes.
Why?
Well, I would say yes in my case because I do not have any further skills with counseling. And for them to come to me rather than to go to a professional counselor because I'm free, that would be taking advantage. That's why I come to every one of these at all these conferences.
Good.
Because counseling is hard for me.
Very good. All right. Well, I don't do a lot of long-term counseling anymore. My role as a pastor just doesn't allow me to do that. When I was a young pastor and thought I could do just about anything and everything, you know, I'd counsel people for weeks upon weeks upon weeks because that's how I was trained in my master's degree, so that's what I would do. Don't do a lot of long-term counseling anymore. I do a lot of short-term counseling because the schedule indicates that that's what I can do. It's all that I can do. And so, as I say, I have people who come to me because I'm free from both inside and outside the church. But when I think about that, the reason that's an important question for us to ask and why I even begin this very hour with that question is the way I answer that question determines my attitude. It determines my perspective. It determines the amount of passion and energy I'm going to give to that session. It determines how real I'm going to be or how present I'm going to be in that session. And I could go on and on and on and on, and all of that refers back, it loops back to this essential question, are you ever taken advantage of in ministry? Are you ever taken advantage of in ministry? If I feel that I am taken advantage of, this is my perspective, and I'll let you process it however you want to, then I think that limits who I will counsel and help. It will also limit how I will counsel or help. If my main motivation is to avoid being taken advantage of, and if not my main motivation, one of my main motivations. It makes a huge difference. I'm going to read to you something that I think is probably familiar to most of you, and it'll kind of dovetail into what we're going to say next. This person said, I look upon all the world as my parish. Thus far I mean that in whatever part of it I am, I judge it meet, right, and bound in duty to declare unto all that are willing to hear the glad tidings of salvation. This is the work which I know God has called me to, and sure I am that his blessing attends it. Great encouragement I have, therefore, to be faithful in fulfilling the work he has given me to do. His servant I am, and as such am employed according to the plain direction of his word. As I have opportunity doing good unto all men, and his providence clearly concurs with his word, which has disengaged me from all things else, that I might singly attend on this very thing and go about doing good. You know who said that? Okay, that's Mr. Wesley. I had to wrestle with that in the early years of my ministry and counseling services particularly, because is all the world to John Mara my parish? At least the part of it that I am in. Is that my parish? And do I have a responsibility if God allows people to cross my path in the part of the world that I am in? Do I have a responsibility to be present, available for those people as he should direct? This is the answer that I've come up to. Yes. Anyone, everyone, as I am able, I will counsel whether they pay me or not. For, and I'm going to go ahead and read this because I have it written in here specifically. No one takes advantage of me when I willingly lay down my life for them or serve them in any way that I can as God leads, whether they pay me or not. For there's a huge difference, class, those who have been in my class, in getting paid to minister or ministering and I get paid. Huge difference in motivation there. And it will affect how you feel and how you serve yourself. Because do you ever have a right in God's service and in the place that he has positioned you to determine who you're going to serve, when you're going to serve them, and how you're going to serve them? And I'm talking about in a motivational sense first, because we're going to get to something that she said in just a moment, because that has to enter this discussion. So it's an attitudinal place of determining who you are. You know, I don't get paid to pastor my church. And if I think that I get paid to pastor that church, then my expectations are set in a certain arena, and I'm going to be disappointed within that arena. I don't get paid to do that. I'm thankful that I get paid as I do it. But I don't get paid to do that. And if you think you get paid to minister or specifically paid to counsel, get ready for disappointment, disillusion, improper motivation, and less than effective service. Because you're always evaluating, am I being taken advantage of? Is this fair to me? Is this what I really should be doing? I don't even know you. I don't even like you. You don't even come to my church. Interesting? Or not? I think it makes a huge difference, because in making that decision, here's what I've come to. There's not one person that walks the face of this earth that can take advantage of me. No one. Not when I'm willingly doing what I'm doing, letting God direct what I'm doing, and having the right motivation for doing it. No one takes advantage of me, which means I am free to serve any way I want, anywhere I want, with whomever I want, not worried about the cost or the payment for what I do. So that leads, quickly, we've got to run there, to consideration number two, which is what was said here just a moment ago. Do I know how to set, then, God-honoring boundaries? God-honoring boundaries. And at first hearing, that could sound like a contradiction to everything that I just said, but really it's an essential part of what I've just said. Because here's the truth. If I'm going to be effective, and you know this, you could probably teach this, talk about this better than I could. If I'm going to be effective in giving care, I have to take care of myself. If I'm not taking care of myself, I can't give any kind of care that would be really effective. If I don't take care of myself, it'll be minimally effective. And if I don't take care of myself, because I've been here, and I hate to say this to you, I've been in places where I haven't taken very good care of myself, and I've actually created more harm than I did good, because I wasn't in a good place, because I didn't take care of myself. All right, so healthy boundaries is a huge issue in this whole arena of what we're talking about. It's not a selfish thing. It's an equipping thing. I don't know if we could somehow run the tape of your life and see how well you take care of yourself. Anybody in here, you think you take care of yourself as well as you possibly could? You're doing great at that. You're a 10. I want to see your hand. Are you?
No.
No, okay. Right. I don't see any hands. Okay, all right. Your effectiveness dovetails into that number somewhere, and it does in counseling as well. Because if you're going to counsel, guess what? You have to give your heart, your soul, your emotion. You have to be fully present. You have to be real and authentic. And you can't do that when you're running low on gas. So you have to take care of yourself. So back to consideration number one for a moment. I don't think I have a right to set my boundaries on who I serve, where I serve, what I serve for, how much I get paid to serve. I don't think I have a right to set that boundary. That's God's determination. He'll place me in the parish, the part of the world he wants me to be. That's up to him. But I think I do have a responsibility to be so ready to serve those people that I set a healthy boundary and say that the only time I cannot help you is when I have to be taken care of myself so that I can help you. In other words, I will say no on my schedule to, can't do it, don't have it to give. I'll get there, but I can't do it right now because I'm not there. I have to take care of me. The greatest tool you have in counseling anyone is who you are. Not techniques, not what books you've read. It's who you bring to the table that you are as a person. Fully alive, refreshed, rejuvenated, in touch with the Lord, ready to go, impassioned, compassionate, sincere. Because I believe that God calls us to a whatever it takes mentality. I love to hire staff. I particularly hire young staff because I love young staff's eagerness to do what they are called to do. But with one of my staff people actually here, and she's heard me say this before, I hire usually, and more so in these last 10 years, I want to see a whatever it takes mentality. Don't tell me that this isn't a part of your job description. Don't tell me you're not willing to do that. Don't tell me you're going to pick and choose because they're going to take advantage of you if you do this. But you better be taking care of yourself. Pastor Sarah is here. She is the embodiment of what I've just described. She's also the embodiment of someone who knows how to take care of herself. I don't know how you got that so early, but you take care of yourself very well. And when she serves, she is all there. So it's been a great encouragement to me, and she's an example of exactly what we're talking about today. So being able to help somebody means there have to be times when I can't help somebody because I have to help me first. Okay? So that's how that fits in with number one. I'm all in, whatever it takes, wherever it takes, whatever costs, Lord, but I know I've got to take care of myself. And we do a disservice to people when we don't take care of ourselves. So there's a big difference in why you say no. You say no, on one hand, don't know you. No, I'm never going to see you. You don't even tithe or give anything to my church. Versus, no, I won't see you because right now I can't. Because I have to be fully present when I do, so right now I have to take care of me. Okay? Huge difference in how you say no. What this leads to, and this is the one I'm probably going to dwell on more than any of the others, the rest of these will move a little more quickly, is if I am in a position of running at a deficit, and maybe you can identify with this, maybe you can't. When I'm running in a deficit position in terms of how I care for myself, but I'm over here giving, 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 not saying no, helping all that I can, seeing God orchestrate people that cross my path, all my world is a parish, at least the part I'm in. What a wonderful opportunity. I'm giving, 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 but I'm not taking care of myself, and there is a deficit. What do you think happens? Give me an idea. What happens there? What are some of the results of that reality, do you think? And the care that you're going to be able to give or not give.
Like a dynamic of resentment.
Did you come look at my notes?
No.
Say it again.
There's a dynamic of resentment.
There's a dynamic of resentment, yes. I'm going to resent those people for requiring so much of me. Then I start to feeling like I've been taken advantage of, but it's not their issue. It's not their fault. It's mine. I haven't taken care of myself. I haven't set boundaries. I'm not rightly motivated. But when I start resenting them, then I'm not serving them the way I can. I'm certainly not honoring God, and I'm actually injuring myself because then I have a viewpoint of ministry that starts to get skewed. And you know people whose viewpoint over ministry has gotten skewed over the years? I came to a conference like this years ago, and someone in that conference, and I've moved around some too, everybody in here has, so don't take any personal offense to this, okay? But I heard at a conference many years ago, somebody said, the average Nazarene pastor has 3 to 4 years of experience, 8 to 10 times. You get the math? And a lot of it has to do with resentment, the issues that are caused by not setting healthy boundaries, by being improperly motivated, and by actually doing more harm than good when you interact with people. Because a person who's running on this deficit, guess what they do? Not only are they not serving well, not only are they hurting themselves and maybe even their family, they're creating a schism in their own church. I've seen churches blow up because pastors weren't taking care of themselves and weren't wise in how they set their boundaries, therefore not giving appropriate care, setting up resentment on the part of the people. They now have resentment because the people are resentful, and boom, it explodes, and now we're done, and we just move on somewhere else. But guess what? I heard Chuck Swindoll say this years ago, whether he coined it or not, wherever you are, guess what? There you are. There you are. So it's very important here as a consideration to set boundaries. All right? Theoretical. We'll move to some practical things here in a moment. Consideration number three. How self-aware are you? This is huge. I would say that if you are not a very self-aware person, please do not engage in pastoral counseling. Please do not create a fog in other people because you have a fog in yourself. If you're self-unaware, don't enter the counseling room at all. You can't go there. William Willimon said, this is in a text that I use in my class, we must not let those who are ignorant of themselves be in the morally demanding position of pastor. If you don't know you, if you're not aware of your strengths, weaknesses, need for energy, refueling, how you refuel, if you're not attendant to the relationships in your family and aware of how they're doing, don't go out and try to help people with that lack of self-awareness. You'll create difficult issues. And then, what would you say would be one of the main objectives of counseling? And I learned this in a secular environment, but it's true in the environments that we're in. When those people walk in to see you, they are needing to come to a place of a brand new and fresh awareness of themselves, of their situation, and of God. But how are you going to help them find a fresh awareness in those arenas when you're so clouded in your own? You can't lead people places you've never been or are not currently. So for a counselor to be self-unaware is to be a detriment in the room with another person who's needing that awareness. Self-awareness is huge in counseling. So let me just do this and see how self-aware you are, all right? I want you to think, how are we doing on time? I want you to think of a movie character, a TV character, a story character, a book character, someone you look at and you say, I want to be like them, or I want to be like them in that situation, or I'd like to have that character trait, and I can see it in someone else, and we'll just relegate it to movies, TV, books, stories, plays, something like that. A character that you identify with that you'd like in some way to be like. It's a bridge of awareness. You recognize something of value that you'd like to have in your own life. So let's do that now. Who has a character that you'd like to share that you'd like to be like? How aware are you?
Colonel Potter.
MASH. Why? Wait, does everybody know who you're talking about? Do you know who she's talking about?
Oh,
tell us
sorry.
Quickly. Tell us quickly. Who is Colonel Potter?
Okay, Colonel Potter was the leader of a MASH unit in Korea. It was a kind of a comedy with a kind of a dark side too that ran for a long time as a movie.
Why?
He was good to his people, but he was wise, and he spoke truth, and yet he did it with humor. And
that is so funny. I don't know you well. I mean, I've been around you off and on. That resonates perfectly with who you are. I can see why you would say that.
I see it.
Very good. Somebody else, quickly. What character trait do you see? What personality do you see that, at least to a degree, I'd like to be like that? I admire that. What is it? Have one? No? Anybody? Who?
Reverend Camden.
Seventh Heaven.
Why? Why him?
Well, he only preaches for about 3 minutes when you see him preach.
Okay.
Even though he has a church and his church obligations, he's really connected to his family.
Good. Well said. All right. One more, and then I'll tell you mine. One more.
Well,
Anybody? Who would you like to be like? A trait, characteristic. Yes, sir.
Barney Fife.
You had me thinking about old TV shows. He had a heart of gold. He only carried one bullet, so he was prepared. And he didn't always think before he acted, but he always tried to do the right thing. I can kind of relate to that.
Interesting. I've asked this question a lot of times over the years. I've never had anybody say Barney Fife. Barney Fife. Do you know Barney Fife? Do you guys know Barney Fife? You don't really know Barney Fife. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Mine would be...
And I have another self-discovery. I must be old.
Yeah. Yes, you might be. You might be. Mine would be George Bailey. Who knows George Bailey?
Okay, yeah.
George Bailey. I mean, the guy is as loyal can be. And to me, loyalty is one of the highest values and one of the toughest values to find today. I hope I'm at least a little bit like George Bailey. All right? So what all this suggests then is self-awareness, but it's a self-awareness that you're going to bring into a counseling situation with the people that knock on your door and want to see you, so that you can then usher them into other self-awareness about who they need to be as they address their problems. Because let's be honest, you have to address who a person is before you're going to talk to them about their problems. What happens if you fix a problem, but the person remains the same? They're going to repeat that. Nothing's changed. You've just kind of shuffled the cards around, but they're going to keep being that same person. So when it comes down to counseling then, one of the things that's huge to learn, and I learned this on my sabbatical from Dr. Henry Cloud. If you ever want to get a good book to read, it's this one, Integrity by Dr. Henry Cloud. He says quite simply, character always precedes competency. Who you are is more important than the skills you have, which is why right now in this presentation today, we're talking about those things before we talk about any practical tools. And in the counseling room, please, I beg you, don't try to fix people's problems without first understanding them and bringing them to an understanding of who they are. Because I promise you, 90%, if not 100% of the time, the reason they have a problem resides within themselves. They've always been a part of it, an accomplice to it somehow. And if you don't address that with an awareness here, in terms of their character and who they need to become, all you're going to do is put a Band-Aid. I'll be honest with you, I've served on a couple different districts, talked to a lot of pastors. Pastoral counseling puts a lot of Band-Aids on. It just does. Now you may say, well, you just said you don't counsel long-term. How are you going to do more than that in a short-term? You can. And we'll talk about that here in just a moment. Okay? All right, let me just stop. Any questions so far? I know I'm moving quick because I got some good stuff here I want to share with you. Anything else? Okay.
One thing pops to my mind. In pastorate, you have, whether it's a associate position of some sort or senior pastor, it's easy to get caught into, you don't want to say no to people, but then again, you're not working. I mean, and I'm not talking about money thing here, but you know, if you're working full time or part time, wouldn't it be wise to ask how many hours you expect me to work a week and stick close as you can to them versus let's say they want you 25 hours a week part time, and you're putting in 70 or 80, you're not keeping yourself healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But then after you've been doing that for a while, you bring that down, then you get people angry with you because they don't think you're doing what you used to be doing anymore. How do you conquer that?
Yeah, you raised like three or four different issues in your question. It's a great question. It really is. In fact, let's talk more after class about some of the other things. But one thing I will attend to right now is you do run the risk of setting the bar so high because you're in a particular frame of mind or season of life or high energy mode that people would come to expect that. But that's where I think the longevity of your tenure someplace helps people see a bigger picture of who you are rather than just look at one specific moment in time and think you're always going to be that way. You know, I've been where I am now for like 17 or 18 years. Phil's been there, I think, equally as long. How long have you been in Garnett?
29.
Wow, that much longer. Okay. I think the longer you are somewhere, the more you're able to have a natural ebb and flow to where expectations don't become the norm because, you know, you were just on it right then, and it's like, wow, look at the work he's doing and how hard he's going, and the expectation won't necessarily be there because they'll see more of the ebb and flow to the longevity that you bring to that, and they'll come to trust that. Now, you can take advantage of that trust, and I've got examples of that in my life where I've seen that happen. But if you've had that kind of trust, which we're going to talk about in a moment, I think they're a little more grace-giving in terms of some of the natural ebb and flow because they know you to be a person of integrity, and they're not worried that, well, right now he's not working as hard as we saw him work 6 months ago. But they trust that. And if you're a person of integrity, they should trust that because you're having to take care of yourself. So kind of answering it in a ballpark sort of way, but let's talk more afterwards if you'd like to.
Okay.
I'd love to. Good question. Great question. Okay. That then leads to, to finish that consideration, the ultimate tool that you bring to counseling, since that's what this course or this hour is entitled as a toolbox, the ultimate tool is who you are, all right, your character, who you bring to the table, your makeup, okay? Consideration number four, I just alluded to it, can you engender trust? Are you trustworthy? Do the people you serve and the people you're going to counsel sense that? I believe that in the first 5 minutes of a person walking into your office or the room where you're going to do counseling, wherever that is, they know whether you can be trusted or not. They know whether you're confidential. They know whether you're going to attend to them without judging them. They know that you're going to listen to them without trying to prescribe some quick fix. They determine those things in the first 5 minutes. At least I can. Now, I know I come from a different perspective, but I think most people have this intuitive sense whether or not you can be trusted or not. I think a lot of that will come from those first three considerations, especially if you're talking about pastoral counseling in terms of a local church, kind of like what I think you and I were dialoguing about a moment ago. How do you engender trust in a counseling situation? How do you think it's created? I think it's created primarily one way. For that session then to have the foundation of trust upon which everything can be said and explored and processed and confronted, I think there's one way to build that kind of trust. And that is that you make it very clear, in fact, maybe the entire first session, I want to understand where you're coming from. I've had sessions where I say 150, 200 words max, and I'm just listening. I am just listening. Because I want to understand your frame of reference, your pain, your brokenness, your need. That will create trust. And from there, we can go anywhere. Because in the counseling that I do, I'm kind of like Dr. Phil. I'm going to confront you. But I'm going to do so out of love and trust and empathy and understanding. But I've got to convey that first if we're going to get to the truth. If I'm going to be Colonel Potter in your life, I've got to have that trust first. And you develop that by saying, I'm here to understand you. Not prejudge, not sitting here thinking about what I'm going to say next. Have you ever talked to somebody and you can tell they're just thinking about what they're going to say and they're not really listening to you? I sure have. Happens in foyers and churches every Sunday morning. Where they're not really listening, they're just waiting to talk. Counselors do that. I've been to counseling. I won't ask how many of you have been to counseling. I've been to counseling two separate times in my life. One counselor was awful. Didn't care about anything I had to say, only was waiting to show me how much she knew. The second time I went to counseling, I couldn't shut up because that guy gave me all kinds of space. And quite honestly, the best thing he did was let me talk, because in the course of really listening to myself in a safe environment, I started to figure some things out and come to self-awareness. And then when he did speak, it was like, man, you get me. You got it. You know how good it feels to be gotten? How good it feels to be understood? Oh, man, that's huge. So it's huge in a counseling relationship from counselor, pastoral counselor, to the people you're counseling. But guess what else is huge? When you do couples counseling, let's say. When couples come to see me for counseling, and my master's degree is in marriage and family counseling, almost invariably, a couple will come to see me wanting me to be the referee and hoping that I'm going to agree with one of them so that I can take their side and together we'll convince you and show you where you're wrong and you need to change. There's a sense of we've got to agree here. Help her see, help her agree with my perspective. Help him see it my way. Well, the highest form of pastoral counseling here in this whole trust arena and the need for in that room is not that they ever agree with each other, but at least that they understand where they're coming from. Because if you get me and you understand me, whether I agree with you or not, we can still dialogue. We're still in the game together. But if you don't even get me, you don't even understand what I'm saying, let alone agree with it, then I'm on Mars and you're on Venus. And we're never going to make that connection because you don't understand where I'm coming from. So you have to engender that trust by wanting to become aware, help them get aware, and then helping them each be aware so they can develop the same kind of trust. If they trust each other, they can work on anything. The marriages that have ended, sadly, under my pastoral leadership have been those marriages that could never bridge the gap of understanding each other because they would only fight trying to make sure that one was going to win the battle of agreement. And since they couldn't agree, they divorced. If they could have only understood, then they could have dialogued to a new conclusion. And that's your job, I believe, in counseling. Awareness, understanding. It's got to be created on all kinds of levels. Sounds theoretical, it's really very practical. If they walk out of that room, they don't look back at that counseling room as an arena of understanding, then I think you've lost the pastoral counseling battle. Empathy is really what we're talking about. And aside from who you are as the greatest tool, I believe empathy is the second greatest tool. If you don't have it, read on it, Google search it, go to seminars, talk to empathetic people, prayerfully ask God to show you how to be empathetic. How can you be a pastoral counselor without it? You can't be. But don't despair if you don't feel like you have it. I believe it's a skill that some of us are born with, but it's a skill that can very easily be learned if you want to. If you want to. All right. Let's move to consideration number 5. How many of you remember the movie? I think it was entitled A Few Good Men. Do you guys remember that movie? I'm doing all the old stuff here, aren't I? Do you know who Tom Cruise is?
Yeah.
Demi Moore? Jack Nicholson? Ever seen that movie? A Few Good Men?
I know it exists. I know it's out there.
What's that?
You can't handle
it. That's right. That's where we're headed. Yes. Yes. Tom Cruise is the attorney, and he's grilling Jack Nicholson because his crime has been committed, this great cover-up. And Tom Cruise gets, I just want the truth. And then Jack Nicholson in that classic scene, you can YouTube it, says, you can't handle the truth. Truth, and this gets down to kind of that what I was talking about a moment ago, once understanding and trust and empathy have all been developed and like the arena and the atmosphere and the air is filled with it, now it's time. You got to get to the truth. You got to nail the truth. And you got to get there. Because that's really where all the change lies. In this book that I use in class that I read on sabbatical, Dr. Cloud talks about something they do at, or they used to do, I don't know if they still do, at the Willow Creek Church in Chicago. With the staff, they'll have these very open, honest, almost confrontive sessions where they'll say to the other person in staff, and I've done this once with staff I had been with a long time. I'm about to do it again here sometime soon. But they ask the question, what's it like to be on the other end of me? I probably know 90% of what you think, and you probably would tell me 90% of what you think, but the Willow Creek exercise that they do is, but tell me the last 10% that nobody else probably would tell me. I want to hear it. And he talks about it then in these tones and terms of how revolutionary that's been in terms of the trust and the truth and the change and just the momentum that gets created when you're trafficking in full truth. And you're not dealing with just shades of truth or percentages of truth. Your job in a pastoral counseling setting, I think, because it usually is short term, is you got to get to the truth, and you got to get there in a hurry, but you got to get there only after these other things first. First things first. Can you imagine if somebody comes to me, let's say that they're from outside my church or they're in my church and I don't know them very well, and in the first session I just nail them with some hard-hitting, tell me the truth, this is what I really think you're saying, this is what I really heard, I mean just... You can't do that. But there is a time and a place for something similar to that when it's done in the right way. So the truth, you have to be focused on truth and not just shades of it. When the pastoral counseling time is over, whether that's 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 1 week, whatever, there has to be a point in time where you sign off and you know we've dealt in truth. The light was shined. There's probably not anything else I could have done or any way I could have led that would have made it even more truthful. If you haven't gotten to the truth, then again, I think it's Band-Aid. It's all Band-Aid. All right, consideration number six then, and these all kind of fit and flow with the other. Do I see, and can I help the people I counsel see, that as painful as this situation might be right now, there's a wonderful opportunity that awaits us? Now, how you say that is critical, because you don't want to be pie in the sky and everything is fine, everything's coming up daisies and somebody's hurting. But you have to convey somehow a sense of what I'm talking about really here is hope. There is hope. We're going to utilize it. We're going to pursue it. There's an opportunity here. You have to help them see that. A lot of times what they come to us for, what they come to me for, maybe you, is the alleviation of their pain. But what we're really after, I think, ultimately, is a change of some kind in their heart, in who they are, then in their circumstances. And that will come as seeing things as an opportunity, and that problems are a natural and inevitable piece of life. Again, referring back to Dr. Cloud, he says that the ones who succeed in life are the ones who realize that life is largely about solving problems. And he quotes then M. Scott Peck, who's a Christian psychiatrist. M. Scott Peck says, "Once we truly know life is difficult, truly understand and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it's accepted, the fact that it's difficult really doesn't matter anymore, because that's just the way it is." What did Jesus say? He said, "In this world you won't have trouble. In this world you will have it. So accept it, embrace it, and let's get on with it." So, pastoral counseling. This is one of the better things. If you haven't liked anything else so far in our time, you might like this. I think pastoral counseling is at its best when it helps people embrace their problems. Not run from them, minimize them, or quickly solve them. Embrace them. To that point, let me share this with you. Great book. I would recommend you get it if you don't have it. It's called The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen. Great book. Specifically, the best part of that book, pages 92 and 93. Let me read just a couple of paragraphs. He says, "Perhaps the main task of the minister is to prevent people from suffering for the wrong reasons. Many people suffer because of the false supposition on which they've based their lives. That supposition is this: that there should be no fear, no loneliness, no confusion, and zero doubt. But these sufferings can only be dealt with creatively when they're understood as wounds that are integral to the human condition. Therefore," he says, "ministry is a very confronting service. It doesn't allow people to live with these illusions of immortality or wholeness. It keeps reminding others that they will be mortal, they are mortal, and they will be broken, but also that with the recognition of this, now true liberation begins. No minister or pastoral counselor can save anyone. He or she can only offer himself or herself as a guide to fearful people. A shared pain in a counseling setting is no longer paralyzing, but when it's shared, it becomes mobilizing and understood now as a way to a new liberation. When we become aware that we don't have to escape pain, but that we can mobilize it into a search for the meaning of life itself, then those very pains get transformed from despair into hope." I love that. So you embrace your pain. You embrace it. Thomas Merton once said, the light into which we emerge shines all the brighter against the darkness from which we have come. So embrace it all, because each gives meaning to the other. And that's our job. That's our job, to instill that in the sessions that we're in. Which will lead me to number 7. We're almost out of time here. We've got about 14 minutes left, 13 now. When you counsel in a pastoral setting, please listen to more than the words. Words will only tell you maybe half the story. The rest of the story will be seen in their eyes, in the tilt of their head, in the slump of their shoulder, in the fidgetiness of their hands or feet. Their posture, their tone, their body language will shout to you if you pay attention. How many of you have ever seen the Benedict Cumberbatch version of the Sherlock Holmes series on TV? Anybody? Only just a handful of you? Wow, go YouTube that. Yeah. Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, and his attention to detail and the things he learns just by observing that other people miss, because they only are looking for the most obvious things, like words. I show a clip of that in my class, of how much he can learn just by looking at someone. And you can do the same thing in class. For instance, here's what I do frequently. I'll be sitting across from someone in a pastoral counseling setting, and all of a sudden I will see a change in their eyes. There's like a mist, or now the eyes aren't as open as they used to be. They're slightly closed. So there's an emotion going on there. If I see that, I call it now. I don't wait for that. I don't wait and think they're going to tell me about that. I say, I see something in your eyes right now. What's going on? What's that mean right there? Tell me about that. And then we're off and running. If you miss that because you're just waiting for words, then you're not being a fully attendant pastoral counselor. Because I believe the Holy Spirit will give you the ability to discern more than words, but to discern posture. How many of you preach occasionally, somewhat, ever? Can't you just read your congregation? Don't you just know if you're doing it or not? Their body language is telling you that, isn't it? You can tell that. In a counseling room, it's exactly the same. And if you miss those signs, I don't care how many skills, how many classes, how many techniques, how many books, how many seminars you've been to, what questions you're just waiting to ask, what tips you just can't wait to share with them, forget it. There's something going on in their eyes right there that you missed, which may be the most important thing of all. So pay attention to more than just their words. A great pastoral counselor hears what words don't say. All right? How many of you remember that poem? I'm going back to this old crowd, okay? 1966. Please hear what I'm not saying. Anybody remember that poem? Well, I figured you might, okay? It's a great poem. It's very, very long, but the essence of it is this. Don't be fooled by me, and please don't listen to just my words, but observe, because I'm probably telling you everything you want to know if you'll just pay attention. So break through my words and attend to who I am nonverbally, because that's where the truth is. Break through that. Because you see, here's what people do. When people are doing this to you, you know what they're really doing to you? They're doing this right here. Don't ever take this at face value. Happens in counseling all the time. There's resistance in that first session. They're trying to read. Maybe someone sent them there. Maybe it's a couple session. One of them doesn't want to be there, so it's this, this, this. There's always a this behind a this. But you've got to look for that. You've got to be attendant to that. And you've got to try to flesh that out. Okay? So hear what's not being said, and I think the Holy Spirit will enable you to discern some important things. Let's see here. Let me move on. Okay, let me get to this. I think this is important. Another consideration here. How will you handle the conflicting roles that you fulfill? Because if you're a pastoral counselor, if you're doing any kind of counseling, whether it's with youth or young adults or just the people that you're the pastor of, you're wearing those other hats that I spoke about. Those other hats present for you conflict after conflict after conflict in terms of potential conflict that you may or may not be aware of. When I was in graduate school, they talked about what they termed dual role conflict. In other words, should I counsel someone who is my friend? The answer in graduate school is Absolutely not. There's a dual role conflict there. You cannot be fully attendant because you're afraid of harming your friendship, so you can't be completely honest as a pastoral counselor. Well, multiply that now in the average church setting, and here's a case study that I give to my class, and I'll give you the highlights. And listen for role conflict here, okay? Because if you don't understand the conflict that's inherent in this situation or situation like this, you're going to create havoc, create problems. You're really going to have work to do because you weren't paying attention and you got yourself enmeshed in some conflict you shouldn't have. Full-time pastor of a church that averages 100 people. You've been there for 3 years. You have paid staff, part-time secretary, part-time youth, part-time children, small community, rural community. It's about 50 miles from a metroplex. A couple asks you for counseling. They want to see you for pastoral counseling. They've been members of the church where you're at for 15 years, long before you got there, because remember, you've only been there for three. The husband is on the church board, prominent member of the church board. The wife leads the women's ministry, and she's the NWMS president. Anybody remember NWMS? NMI now, I think. Their entire lives revolve around church involvement in this small community, in this small church. Everyone in the church loves, admires, and deeply respects this couple. They are it. Everybody sees them as the model. They have four kids, two boys, two girls. The girls are elementary age. The other two are teens, a boy and a girl. And the teens are strong leaders in the youth group. The other kids look up to those teens. At the time of their request, they have very few family resources because the wife lost her job, and her job was the one that provided insurance for the family. So now they're struggling with their resources. Husband's self-employed business owner. His business isn't doing great. The home is now threatened with foreclosure because of the change in their finances. They're having trouble even putting food on the table and paying their bills. The couple comes to you as their pastor because they see you as someone they trust, but also they have seen you socially. You go out to dinner with them frequently. You spend time at each other's houses. They count you as their friends, and you and your spouse count them as dear friends of your own. So you're looking forward to helping them in some way because they've been a couple that you kind of patterned yourself after. Again, zero resources. And so they're coming to you, and they make no bones about it. Pastor, we're coming to you. Normally, we would go to a professional counselor because insurance would pay for it, or we would pay for it. But we're coming to you because you're free. And we trust you, but you're free. With the first session, you hear their story as it relates to the description that I just gave. And keep in mind, in the first session, you often don't get the full story. You usually don't get it until the second, because they're looking for trust, okay? In the second session, as is so often the case, you hear these hidden details that didn't come out previously that now make the picture clearer and more entangled, and these are they. The husband has admitted he has major issues with pornography. The wife, by her own admission, has trouble with sexual intimacy and has ever since they got married. She has a conservative religious upbringing. She says this is responsible for some of her trouble. In addition, she has some physical issues going on that has made intimacy difficult, so she now fully blames herself for her husband's pornography addiction. By the way, I didn't make this stuff up, just in case you're wondering. This is all kind of historical to people I've dealt with over the years. They both profess now their faith is shaken. They struggle with the concept of a faithful, loving God, because where is he right now? Why hasn't he helped them? The wife feels guilt and shame over what she describes as her hypocritical behavior. We can't imagine what they would think, the other church people, if they only knew what's going on inside our home. The wife wants to resign her position of youth minister, of women's ministry leadership immediately, but the husband is adamant and insists he will not resign from the church board. The wife admits to you that she has had suicidal thoughts. Their teenage son fears his girlfriend may be pregnant. One of the youngest kids is having trouble in school with behavior and grades. And to top it all off, the husband has admitted now that he has abandonment issues from his childhood, never had a great relationship with dad. He feels rejection from his wife. He expresses his deep respect for you, pastoral counselor, and he says, "You are our only hope." Quickly, what are the issues that you better be aware of? And please, somewhat extreme, but not all that. Not all that extreme. What are some issues you better be attendant to now in terms of role and conflict and how there's a bigger picture that's going to be affected by what happens in your relationship with these people? I made some critical mistakes early on, and I learned from them the hard way. What do you think? Give me a few. What did you hear there that you need to be leery of, aware of, I should say? Quickly.
What I'm gathering is how well they're thought of in the church, what the way you treat this thing could possibly cause a big problem in the church.
No question. If they are untreated, if they're treated poorly by you, and everybody esteems them, everybody now is over here, and they're against you, you've let these people we love down. I've seen it happen. Saw churches in Texas that went south because of that thing right there. Pastor did not treat this well-respected family very well. They don't know the full story. They don't know about truth. All they know is what they said, these respected people. So now there's a split in the church. You better be aware of that.
Second thing, they don't believe in you already.
They what?
They have doubts in you.
How so?
Well, they're only going to you because they can't afford to go anywhere else. We would rather go somebody else, but we can't. So this, you're our last resort. In other words, we don't think you have the capability of doing it.
So the only reason you're here is because I'm free.
Right.
Okay. All right. What else? Somebody else. What other issues are there you better be aware of? Quickly. Anybody? How so?
Because he refuses to let his wife resign, and that's not really his decision. Like, if she didn't want to be in that position.
She's resigning. He's not resigning.
I thought he said that she. Oh, no, he isn't.
Yeah, he's saying, I'm not. She can, but I'm not. I'm staying on this board. Don't ask me to resign. Pornography, family, now, I'm on the board. Not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Like, don't ask me to do that because I'm not going to, but I still want you to help me. But I want to still be the same person that I am right now and still appear to be the same person. You just need to fix me.
Okay. All right. What else do you see here? What in terms of just your role and the conflict of roles you have in this situation? Because there are so many.
I think the first thing of either, man or woman, that, he has all these, they're coming because of sexual issues. He's in porno. And, the wife is feeling lonely and so forth, so it could be really easy to be vulnerable in that situation. So you just really need to watch out in that.
Okay. All right. Good.
Developed a close friendship with them prior to this counseling relationship, so you might be concerned about damaging the friendship. You really speak to them.
Okay. Good. So let me ask you a question. You are their pastor. You are their friend. You are the administrative leader of the organization of which they are a part. You serve alongside them in different roles, whether it's ministry, women's ministry, or whatever. Your kids are in the same youth group together, blah, blah, blah. You have all these different role conflicts. Here's my question to you. They come to you, and he says, "You are our only hope." With all these role conflicts going on, do you counsel them? That's not a leading question. I'm not looking for a particular answer. I really want to know what you think. Do you counsel them?
That statement is true.
I'm sorry?
Maybe there's a way to show him and enlighten him that that isn't true, that you're the only. But there are other avenues. You have resources.
But okay, I understand what you're saying. Do you counsel them? Do you agree to see them? No insurance, no funds for any counseling whatsoever. A part of your church, you're their pastor. You've had a relationship with them. They trust you. They see you as their only hope. Do you go ahead now and step into that counseling role? The answer is, you have to decide. Yes or no? Yes or no? Yes or no? If you have a place to send them to?
If I had...
For free?
Resources that, yeah.
Or if you come up with money to pay, help pay?
If there were a way, yeah, to give them the resources.
Okay. So you're going to try to avoid that. And we're going to get to that. I've got to get to that. Yes, I'm sorry. We're already over time. What would you do? You're so seasoned. You're Colonel Potterish. What would you do?
Well, I've been in that situation, brother.
Okay. I'm sure you have.
And some even worse. What I did is we talked together. We cried together. We prayed together. And I said, I will walk every step of this with you. But... we are also going to add an outside source. And I always, it took me about 15 years to get there, but now we have a fund. Our church is poor as church mouse, but we have a fund that I can pull from. And I have a drawer full of resources.
Good, good. Good.
But I have done this where I've set up an appointment every week, and I meet with them every week, and we talk about what's happened at the counselor's office.
Good.
And what's happening.
So you'll be a part of a team, but you won't be the sole source of...
I'm sure I'd screw that up big time.
Okay. All right. Quickly then, let's move to a couple of other things, and I let you go, but I can't just leave that hanging.
No, don't.
What that means then, let me see here. Is that you need to know your referral sources. You need to have a list of them, and you need to know the monetary aspects of them. And you need not just kind of like have gone into the, you know, Google search and just found some names you think sound good. You need to know things about these people, have done your homework, if you're going to be a true source of referral. Know who you're referring to, and that these are people you would go to, and that you would trust with yourself or your family. Very, 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 very important. Last couple things quickly. Pre-engagement counseling. Anybody ever heard of it? Anybody ever done it? Anybody? As a pastoral counselor, I would recommend to you, don't just wait for somebody to come and say, will you do our premarital? We're already engaged. If you have opportunity, make it clear somehow, some way, that you really prefer, as a pastoral counselor, to do pre-engagement counseling. I've got stories where there are people that shouldn't have got married. They did what they thought they should do in premarital just to get to the point of me marrying them. If I had had a less pressure, no ring on the finger, no date set opportunity, I could have asked them some of the hard questions that I ask now in pre-engagement before they ever put a ring on the finger. Because some people don't ever need to put the ring on the finger. Yeah, that happens. But I won't do a wedding, personally, unless I have some counseling, premarital counseling,
yeah,
which is a book and a process.
First session, it doesn't matter what we learn, we're getting married.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And if it's premarital, usually that's the case 99% of the time. Yeah. That's why I think pre-engagement, if you can kind of cast an air that, oh, she really prefers this. Or if you catch wind, like there's a couple in my church a couple Sundays ago. I've seen them. They look like they're getting kind of close. I said, hey, how you guys doing? I'm a pastor. I can ask nosy questions, right? You guys thinking about getting married? Yes, we are. How about pre-engagement counseling? Proactive with that. Because it's very, very important, I think. This changes everything. I'm not going to be that honest. Why do I want some major revelation in the course of premarital when we've got a date set and invitations have gone out? Why do I want some blow-up? Why do I want a postponement? No way. No way. But I do some case studies in class with people that I didn't do the right thing with in premarital counseling that I knew never should get married, or they weren't ready for marriage, and the marriage ended just as I thought it would. If I could have been a little more proactive, I think I would have been a better pastoral counselor. Pre-engagement. If you get nothing else out of this time, pre-engagement. Okay.
Now that I've never heard of, what resource do you use for that?
I make it up.
Okay, yeah.
After all these years with my marriage and family degree, I just say, I'm going to ask you some tough questions. I'm going to be real nosy. If you'll let me be me based on my experience and history and training, and I dive in. And I usually ask things, again, I'm reading body language, I'm listening to history, and then I'm asking questions based on that history. So it's kind of a gut thing, that I do. I'm sure there are resources out there, but I just kind of make it up myself right now. So, All right, last couple things. I think you need to understand where you are in terms of evil and sin, because you're going to face both of those in counseling. Pain and sin, struggle and sin can be the same thing, can be two very different things. For instance, does God cause suffering? They're coming to you and they're suffering. Is it possible God has caused this suffering? Is it possible He initiated this suffering? Is it possible this is what He wants you to walk through right now for His purposes? By His design, by His initiation. How you believe, what you believe about that will color everything you do in counseling and how you attend to struggling people. Maybe you believe God redeems suffering. Maybe you believe He just allows suffering. Do you believe that He initiates it? One of the things we talk about in class is, and Ms. Clough, I will never forget your reaction to this in class. Do you remember?
Hi.
Job?
Yeah, I remember that day.
You remember that day?
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me a little snapshot real quick? What happened?
Well, I feel like I've gone back to that and I'm still conflicted.
Sure, you should be. Wrestle with it. But do you remember what the issue was, how we raised it for our discussion purposes? From Job? Do you remember that?
Well, I remember, though He smite me, that verse.
Excuse me?
Though He smite me, I remember
that was
verse.
Later. But how'd the whole thing open up? Do you remember?
I don't.
Yeah. The whole thing opens up in Job, if you'll recognize this, if I remember my word correctly. He says to Satan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Have you considered my servant Job? He brings it up. He initiates it. Calls him by name. What are you going to do with the belief, if you have one, that God might actually have this as something to get a person on track, to save them, to heal them, to use them, to equip them? Does God cause it, allow it, initiate it, redeem it? What's He do with it? So much of your sessions will be predicated on your belief about that, and you're going to translate that belief whether you want to or not. So be clear on what you believe the options really are when it comes to suffering and pain. Because remember what we said earlier, embracing it is what will actually enable you to be liberated because of it, rather than just be defeated by it. Okay? So with that said, I'm so sorry for taking you over time, but I am finished. We are done. Thank you so much. Let me say a prayer with you, and then I'll be glad to talk with you more if you need to afterwards. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for just the free exchange of thoughts and feelings and truths, and how now you want to help us process those to where we will be more equipped to be who you want us to be in that counseling setting where we don't harm, but we're used by you to heal and to do so many other things that only you could do if we would but be better equipped or more able to understand what you have in mind. Use this time to help us understand more of what you have in mind. In Christ's name, amen.